Next on What's the Frequency, Kenneth?
That the state of our union is strong because our people are strong.
I'm Paul Fisher.
WBAI New York. In approximately 15 seconds, you'll be hearing Health Action. At 1 a.m., Ken Gale will be along with a special edition. Yeah, okay. Ken Gale with a... Ken Gale with a special edition of his comic book show interviewing Mark Hamill coming up at 1 in place of Jim Freund, who was under the weather. But now, let's get to Health Action.
Disastrous.
And as I've been saying for the last day or two, provided we can get the equipment to cooperate. Stand by.
Listener-supported community radio, WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All, and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week. In this week's program, we're going to start out at our first half of the program interview. We're going to be taking a look at a new report that takes a look at hospital charity care in New York, how it's working and not working quite so well, who are the winners and losers, and surprise, surprise, The hospitals that often serve large numbers of uninsured, poor patients in communities of color get the short end of the stick. It's a new report out from the Community Service Society, so we'll be hearing about that and what their recommendations are. And in the second part of the program, Catherine Davis will be here taking a look at clinical trials on meditation and energy healing for stress-related illnesses. So stay tuned for that. But first, we'll start with the Health Action News for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. The Associated Press reports that the attorneys general for New York and Minnesota are suing the Trump administration for abruptly cutting off some federal funding for state health care coverage for more than 800,000 low-income residents in both those states. New York's Eric Schneiderman and Minnesota's Lori Swanson, both Democrats, announced last week that the lawsuit filed in Manhattan federal court accuses the Department of Health and Human Services of withholding more than $1 billion annually from each state. from the states combined, excuse me. The majority of the recipients, more than 700,000, are in New York State, while most of the funding, $1 billion or so, goes to New York. Minnesota has about 87,000 recipients in its program and received about $130 million annually. New York's program is known as the Essential Plan, and Minnesota's is known as Minnesota Care. These states are the only two with special so-called basic health programs created under the Affordable Care Act. Such programs are an option for states to create under the law. The partial funding cutoff for them results from the Trump administration's decision last fall to stop providing reimbursements to insurance companies for discounts on deductibles and co-payments that insurers are required to offer to low-income people and families who buy health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. About one quarter of the funding for these states' programs are at risk as a result of the Trump administration's decision. The newspaper The Hill reports that the Food and Drug Administration approved over 1,000 generic drugs last year, a record number the Trump administration announced last week. The figure came as part of a year-end report from the Department of Health and Human Services and was touted as part of the administration's efforts to fight high drug prices. Approving more generic drugs brings more competition into the market and can help lower prices. Many advocates, though, are disappointed that the Trump administration has not done more to fight high drug prices, given President Trump's tough rhetoric on the issue during the 2016 election campaign and occasionally since then, since taking office. On the legislative front, Congress is considering a bill aimed at increasing competition from generic drugs to lower prices. That bill, known as the CREATES Act, is intended to stop branded drug companies from using delaying tactics to slow down the introduction of generic competitors. Government savings under the new bill could be significant, so it could be included as an offset to pay for a long-term government funding deal that may be coming to a head in the coming weeks. Kaiser Health News reports that nearly one in four women have experienced serious physical violence at the hand of a domestic partner. They often end up in the emergency room or the doctor's office, but they don't typically volunteer the reason for their injuries, and doctors don't always ask about abuse in the home. That failure of communication means that patients may miss out on some help they need and can get. Victims of abuse can suffer long-term health problems, including chronic pain, frequent headaches, depression, diabetes, and asthma. And they have higher health costs than people who've not experienced domestic violence abuse. Yet a growing number of health providers and anti-abuse agencies around the country are beginning to collaborate to identify victims and get them help and services. More doctors now screen their patients for signs of abuse, and more community agencies place victims' advocates inside health centers. Education and counseling for people experiencing domestic violence is also more widely available in clinics and hospitals. Advocates say that hospitals and clinics are ideal settings to respond to the needs of abused women. Doctors have unprecedented opportunity to promote prevention and to respond because they are seeing patients that may not ever reach out to domestic violence programs or to police for help. According to Futures Without Violence, which runs a national resource center dedicated to improving the response of medical professionals to domestic violence. The growing collaboration between the medical profession and anti-abuse agencies is driven in part by the Affordable Care Act, which requires that health plans cover domestic violence screening and counseling. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends doctors routinely question women about violence in the home and refer them to services if needed. The task force concluded in 2013 that intervention could reduce violence and abuse as well as mental and physical health problems. Organizations such as the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the American Medical Association also recommended routine screening and counseling for domestic violence victims. And finally, The Hill reports that after 12 years at the helm, Cecile Richards officially announced last week that she would be stepping down as president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America and turning toward helping Democrats win seats in this year's midterm elections through fundraising, campaigning for them, and advising a number of record women candidates. The move comes as Ms. Richard gears up to promote her memoir, quote, Make Trouble, Standing Up, Speaking Out, and Finding the Courage to Lead, My Life Story. The book will be published in April. Richards became the leader of Planned Parenthood in 2006 and previously served as deputy chief of staff for House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi. Republican politicians and anti-abortion groups cheered the news of her departure. Republicans in Congress attempted to defund Planned Parenthood multiple times last year through Affordable Care Act repeal legislation that ultimately failed. The Trump administration announced recently that it would rescind Obama-era policy that makes it harder for states to defund Planned Parenthood. Trump also signed a bill last year rolling back a rule issued in the Obama administration that prevented states from withholding federal family planning dollars from groups because they provide abortions, groups such as Planned Parenthood. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first interview segment, taking a look at a new report about how hospital charity care does and doesn't work so well here in New York. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In our first interview segment of this week's program, we're going to be taking a look at a new report out from our friends at the Community Service Society that takes a look at indigent care funding for hospitals. That's money that government sources provide to hospitals in New York for uninsured patients and charity care. The name of the report is called Unintended Consequences: How New York State Patients and Safety Net Hospitals Are Shortchanged. Joining us is one of the key authors of the report, Carrie Tracy, who's Senior Director of Health Initiatives at the Community Service Society of New York. Welcome to Health Action, Carrie.
Thank you, Mark.
Before we get into the report itself, let's give a little background first. There's two sides of this issue, I was saying in the introduction. There's sort of, or two aspects, I guess. One is money that goes to hospitals, and the other is how patients access that money. So let's talk a little bit first about the first half, how the money is doled out. The report talks about how things started to change in 2006, or that everything sort of came together in 2006. So where were things at, and how did that play out going forward?
Sure. So the disproportionate share hospital funding is federal funding. The federal government, through the Medicaid program, will match spending by state and local governments on spending on their costs of providing care to low-income people, so uninsured low-income people or folks who are insured through Medicaid. So the point of this DSH funding is to help hospitals that are serving a disproportionate share of folks who are low-income and make sure that those hospitals have the resources that they need to do that well. So New York State receives $3.6 billion in DSH funding through state, local, and federal funding.
And that's every year?
That's every year.
Okay.
And so they stole it out in sort of four different buckets, and one of those buckets is called the Indigent Care Pool. And so that funding, there's a pool of funding within that for public hospitals and a pool for nonprofit hospitals. And New York is unusual of all the states because we provide indigent care pool funding to virtually every hospital in the state. In some states, they just reserve it for the safety net hospitals, usually public hospitals that serve the most folks who are uninsured or insured through Medicaid.
And why and how does that happen? Because 90% sort of struck me as a high number. Are 90% of our hospitals across the state really serving large numbers of uninsured patients?
So the number of uninsured and Medicaid patients that hospitals have vary, and we show in our report, we looked at the discharges, what percentage of a hospital's discharges are folks who are uninsured with Medicaid, and so it varies pretty widely. It makes sense in New York State, and in the big cities, we have public hospitals, and they serve a lot of folks who are uninsured, low-income, and have Medicaid, and those are the hospitals that in other states would be the only DSH funded hospitals. But in New York State, we have a lot of communities that don't have these big public hospitals, right? In all these rural communities, small towns, the only hospital is a nonprofit hospital.
Okay.
And so if you're uninsured in that town and you have to go to the hospital, that's where you go. So if every hospital is following the rules and providing financial assistance to people, it makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
You know, to have hospitals have access to the pool. But if hospitals aren't providing that that access to financial assistance, or if our DSH funding in New York State gets cut radically, we have to think about whether that's the best use of these scarce dollars.
Okay, and we'll get to that conversation in a minute. So this is mm-hmm. where things start in 2006. We've got this gigantic pool of money. It's being mm-hmm. doled out. And then in 2012, your organization, your agency, puts out a report that takes a look at how it's all going. What did that report find?
Sure. So there were some reforms in, I can't remember if it's 2006. I think it was 2008. I'm not sure. But advocates for many, many years had been looking at the system and trying to help patients get financial assistance. What they found was when you called a hospital that was getting this money, the Indigent Care Pool, and said, hey, can you send me the application so I can apply for financial assistance? Many hospitals were saying, oh, we don't do that. We don't give financial assistance. We don't have an application. You can't get a discount. And so advocates worked for many years, and then through those reforms, the hospital financial assistance law was enacted. And so that hospital law said, if you take this funding, you have to have an application form. You have to have a policy. You have to make it readily available. You have to help patients apply for it, and you have to follow certain rules. And at the same time, they made 10% of the funding available through a more accountable method. So the old method was just sort of a slush fund, and so hospitals would report how much they spent on bad debt, which meant sending people to collections, versus how much they were spending on financial assistance. And some of the hospitals that were getting a lot of money had really high proportions of bad debt.
So they were not really using it necessarily to pay for care for uninsured people, but just help them balance their books at the end of the year.
That's possible. So bad debt would be like people who are uninsured and the hospital wasn't able to collect money, but the hospital tried. And so they might send the person to collections, place a lien, things like that.
But it could have also been for insured people that didn't pay.
But they didn't get help.
Yeah,
they didn't get financial help. So in 2012, we looked at how that system was working and whether the hospitals, once that hospital financial assistance law had been in place and we had some data about hospitals reporting how many people they were serving and how much they were spending on uninsured folks who qualified for financial assistance, we compared that with how the funding was distributed, and we found that very few hospitals had their applications available on their websites, and if you tried, you could sometimes get a hold of their applications, but sometimes not, and it was really difficult. There were a lot of errors in the applications. They were sort of violating the rules, and there wasn't a strong connection between hospitals that were doing a lot of financial assistance and hospitals that were getting a lot of money.
So let's pause here for a minute, because I think for the listeners, I suspect a lot of listeners don't know that hospitals are required to provide financial aid to patients, who particularly who are uninsured. So just tell us the basics of that. What should a patient know?
Sure. So under the rules, the hospital financial assistance law, hospitals have to have a financial assistance policy. They have to offer a sliding scale discounts for people up to 300% of poverty. They can do more than that. So some hospitals, like
that's
the
a floor
hospital
for them.
Corporations, right, in New York City, some hospitals go up to 400 or 500% of poverty.
Okay.
And so they have to have an application form. There are certain things they can't ask patients for. They're supposed to make it as simple as possible.
But this is a program, so if I'm an uninsured patient that meets this income guideline, I should be able to get a discount on services. I just have to apply for it.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, so that's important. Listeners out there know that this exists, because I bet probably you don't know this. So back to your report then. In 2012, the first report you did, what did it find was happening around this issue of patients accessing these funds that are provided to hospitals that are supposed to help pay for care for uninsured patients?
So in that report, we found that there were many, many errors in the applications. It was really difficult to get a hold of the applications, and that many hospitals that were getting a lot of financial assistance weren't doing a good job, according to their own reports, of providing financial assistance to patients.
And what was happening to patients in that experience?
So patients might not be able to get it. They might not know that their financial assistance was available. They might not be able to get a hold of an application. They might get the application and see how difficult it would be to apply and just decide that they wouldn't qualify and they shouldn't even try. Or they might not be able to complete all the paperwork and get an application through.
So the upshot of that was the hospitals are getting this money. It's not necessarily connecting to any patient. The patients, if they go and receive services, is getting sent to, their bills are going to collection agencies and all of that.
Exactly. Or they might be discouraged from going to the hospital that would be best for their care and going to a different hospital because they felt that they'd have a better chance of getting the financial assistance at the other hospital. So some hospitals were sort of sending, you know, patients directly or indirectly to other hospitals, right? If you make it really hard to get financial assistance, then people just won't go there.
Right. Okay, so that may be a way that the given hospital could game the system, but let's move on from that conversation. So in 2012, your agency puts out this report, and state government does respond. What did they do at that point?
Well, if you remember 2011, 2012 was when the Medicaid redesign team was working.
And here so in New York, that's a special process, right? Governor Cuomo set up to streamline and make Medicaid more efficient program.
Exactly. So there was a work group that was convened as, through that Medicaid redesign team project, and that included some consumer advocates and some hospitals and representatives of the hospitals and then some state officials. And that team together looked at the distribution formulas and also at the ways that hospitals were consumer experiences and came up with some recommendations for the state that were adopted.
Mm-hmm. And what were those recommendations?
So one of the recommendations was about how the money was to be distributed. And that was to go 100% of the new, more accountable formula that had been used for part of the money in the past. So that new accountable formula says hospitals report how many services they provide to uninsured people, and the state multiplies that by the Medicaid rate for those hospitals, subtracts any money they got from patients. So if somebody's really wealthy and they're uninsured, they would pay full price to the hospital, and so that gets subtracted. And then they compare Medicaid usage in that hospital and come up with a formula to distribute the funding.
All right. And so that sort of was the change they made, and things have been chugging along. So essentially this new report that we're about to dive into now then is sort of an update on the first report. Is that a correct sort of understanding?
It is, yeah. Okay. So there are a couple more aspects to what happened in 2012 that are really key.
Okay.
So one of those is that the hospital said, well, you can't just change the formula on us. Don't, you know, pull the rug out from under us. Give us some time to adjust. So there was a three-year transition period included in these reforms that meant that hospitals would only lose or gain a small percentage of their funding in the first year, slightly more in the second year, and slightly more in the third year. And after that, the formula is supposed to kick in 100%.
Okay.
The state also said the hospitals have to start posting all their materials on their websites, and they also said they would be doing an audit to investigate how well the hospitals were following the hospital financial assistance rules.
Okay. So this report then, I guess, sort of takes a look at that. Before we get into that, however, listeners, sorry to pause yet again. Of course, the Affordable Care Act then comes into full force during this period, and some things start to change in that. Most notably, the funding that's provided to states, including New York, this big federal funding stream that comes in called Disproportionate Share Hospital Funding. What happens and how does that fit into this new situation that the report talks about?
Yeah, this is a really complicated issue. There's so many moving pieces.
Yeah,
so
I know, right.
I'm really sorry. It's hard to talk about. So in the Affordable Care Act, the Congress says they were working through it. They were thinking, how are we going to pay for the Affordable Care Act? And one thing they said was, well, so many more people are going to have insurance. Hospitals won't have as many uninsured patients, so they won't need as much DSH funding. So we're going to cut the DSH funding starting in 2014. But not everything worked out the way people expected with the Affordable Care Act. And also hospitals are very powerful. And so Congress pushed back the date when these cuts to DSH funding would take place. So they pushed it back. And so the final date that they got pushed back to was October 2017.
Which was last fall.
The DSH cuts went to effect, yeah, this past fall. And Congress hasn't passed anything to push those funding cuts back. So many hospitals and consumer groups are asking that Congress delay the DSH cuts again because, again, things aren't really going the way that the ACA expected. There have been a lot of changes in the last year or so, but that hasn't happened yet. So hospitals and state officials are kind of worried. It's not clear whether Congress will do that or not. And if so, in the first year starting this past October, New York State would lose $329 million just in the first year.
Okay.
And the cuts go on and increase every year until 2025, I think.
Uh-huh. Okay, so how does that affect then how New York doles out the money that it does? So it's now getting less money from the federal government. Is there any change?
So it makes a big difference in the way things work out because, as I said, there are four different buckets of funding. The first goes to state hospitals. The second is the indigent care pool, and that's the only pool that gives funding to voluntary, the private hospitals.
Okay.
Then hospitals that are public hospitals outside of New York City, the local governments can put in money and get matching funds.
Okay.
And then finally, the last money, any money that's left over in what New York is allowed to spend on DSH, goes to health and hospitals. And so New York City puts up the matching funds to get health and hospitals their funding.
And that's the public system here in New York City.
Right. So that's a big source of their funding.
Right.
So right now with the system the way it is, all the public hospitals in New York State get 100% of what they're allowed to get under the federal rules. But if these cuts go through and that $329 million comes out of health and hospitals budget, that will no longer be true. And that sort of makes everyone question whether this system is going to work.
Right. And just by comparison, according to your report, that would be about a 40% cut in this federal money that New York City Health and Hospital System gets, which is quite significant, 40%.
It's a really big cut.
Given that New York City Health and Hospitals is the safety net provider for the city of New York. Okay, so now we're here to your report. These DSH funding cuts are in effect. What does the report now say in terms of how things are moving and what needs to happen? Let's take the how things are moving first.
So in 2012, there was the new formula and the three-year transition. And what happened was in 2015, without reconvening that MRT group or having any sort of public conversation, the state extended those transition payments for three more years. So hospitals have now had a total of 6 years of incrementally bigger cuts for hospitals that are getting more than they should under the new formula and other hospitals losing funding. So this is the year that the state could renew that for another 3 years or not, just have us go with the formula that everyone agreed to in 2012. So we wanted to look at how do these transition payments affect hospitals. And what we found was most of the funding, 85% of the funding, is distributed under the new accountable formula. But that still leaves 12 to 15% that's being redistributed each year under the transition payments. So over 4 years, we looked at 2013 to 2016, over $550 million was redistributed from some hospitals to other hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2015, we looked at the 2015 transitions, and what we found was the hospitals that got these windfalls, they were winners under the transition payments, served fewer patients who were uninsured. They approved fewer applications from people for financial assistance, and they spent more money on serving people who are uninsured and eligible for financial assistance. And hospitals that lost money because of this transition formula were more likely to serve uninsured people and give them financial assistance.
Okay, so there was a disproportionate balance there. And what did the report find about, you mentioned the state was going to be doing this audit process. Has the state been doing it, and what has it found?
Yeah, so the state has been doing the audit, and we looked at the audit findings, and what we found was that when hospitals failed some of the questions year after year, and instead of requiring the hospitals to pass those questions, the state just discounted those questions. So when you count in how many questions were discounted and how many questions hospitals were allowed to miss in order to have a passing grade, it came out to about 63%, which if you were in school would be a D or an F, right? That would not be a passing grade, having a 63.
Right.
And moreover, if a hospital passed by just one point, then they didn't have to correct any of the questions that they got wrong. So year after year, a hospital could be missing a really crucial element of the financial assistance law and yet still getting paid their funding. So in 2012, the reform said, we're going to hold 1% of the hospital's funding until they pass the audit. And then if they pass the audit, they get the 1%. And if they don't pass it, then they don't get the 1%. But each hospital, even the hospitals that failed in first years, if they submitted a corrective plan and the state approved it, then they ended up getting the funding from previous years. So no hospital has not gotten paid at all. All the money has gone out, even though many hospitals are failing, even using the easier grading system, and then also hospitals that would have failed if all the questions were passed are getting their funding.
Gotcha.
And what's especially crazy about this is that most of the questions that they're getting graded on, they're evaluating themselves. They get a questionnaire that says, are you doing these things? And hospitals say, we're doing these things. And so they're failing on an open book test, basically. And the state isn't checking to make sure that their answers are correct. So it's right. It's not really what you would think of as an audit, where someone's double checking to make sure that you're really doing the things that you say you're doing. So the audit is not as rigorous as it could be. What we found was it still has helped. Even this not rigorous audit, we see that fewer and fewer hospitals are failing each year. So clearly it's a helpful exercise, but it'd be more helpful if the state followed up and said, you failed this question 3 times in a row. Here's what the real answer is. You need to fix this before you get your funding.
Right. Okay, so we got a couple of minutes or so left. Let's quickly, what does your report recommend? And now that we're in a new legislative session, what are our political leaders saying, if anything, about this situation? So first, what are the recommendations?
So the recommendations report on the hospital side and the funding side, we recommend ending, not renewing the transition cuts. So they would sunset this year if there's no action taken. We say let that happen. Don't renew the transition funding at all.
Okay.
And then on the patient side, one thing that really has worked out well, in 2012, the state said hospitals had to put their applications on their websites, and almost all the hospitals are doing that now, at least putting one of the 3 things that they're supposed to put up. But so we say that, but when you read through those applications, there are still a ton of errors. And so we're recommending that the state stop letting every hospital do whatever they want with their application. And just, there is one template that the state put out many years ago. We're saying every hospital should be required to use the simplest basic form that the state wants to put out. The state can select it, but every hospital should use it. And we also think that they should use New York State of Health Marketplace determinations for income and residency, because most folks who apply for financial assistance go to the marketplace to see if they qualify for Medicaid. Anyway, they get that income determination, and that could skip a whole lot of paperwork if people could just turn in that determination and get financial aid based on that.
And again, you're, in terms of the audits, you're sort of saying stop going so easy on the people who aren't doing so well. Right.
Yes, if you're going to do the audit, make sure that you're checking the answers and that you're grading. You're using all of the questions in the grades. If you think that a question isn't fair because hospitals are failing it, figure out why hospitals don't know something super basic that's in the law, and help them correct it.
Okay. And lastly then, we are in a new legislative session. The governor put out his budget proposals a week or so back. Did he say anything about any of this?
Yes. So the new budget does include a transition, but just for 1 year. And when reporters have spoken to the governor's office about that, they've said that they're concerned that some safety net hospitals that provide a lot of care to uninsured folks and folks with Medicaid, including Brookdale is one hospital that they're saying is an example, would lose money if they had to go to the new accountable formula. And so they're concerned that those hospitals are already pretty stressed financially and that taking this funding away would hurt those hospitals. And so they're saying that they should have 1 year transition and then reconvene the panel that met in 2012, that work group, and have them figure out what the new formula should be.
Right. All right. To protect those outlier hospitals. And we know Brookdale and a few others in central Brooklyn in particular are one of them. Great.
Yeah.
Well, we've been getting a summary of a new report out, taking a look at hospital charity care here in New York. It's from the Community Service Society. The report is titled Unintended Consequences, How New York State Patients and Safety Net Hospitals Are Shortchanged. And I just want to let listeners know there's oodles of tables in this report, and you can look all kinds of information about your local hospital and find out what's going on. So there's a bit of a tease for you. Our guest has been Carrie Tracy, one of the lead authors of the report. She's Senior Director for Health Initiatives at the Community Service Society of New York. Thanks so much for joining us on Health Action, Carrie.
Thank you, Mark.
And that'll do it for the first half of the program. We'll be back for the second half in a moment with Catherine Davis taking a look at clinical trials on meditation and energy healing for stress-related illnesses. Stay tuned.
Welcome. This is Catherine Davis, co-host of Health Action over WBAI Radio in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. On today's program, we're going to have a bit of a tutorial on relaxation, meditation, and how we can use simply our mind, our hearts, our bodies to release stress, to move into this exciting area of self-healing and transformation. My personal experience in teaching meditation is meditation in the context of Qigong practice. And Qigong is essentially a moving meditation, but it includes sitting meditation, laying meditation, walking meditation, and exercises, movements that are similar in appearance to Tai Chi, but have more of a contextual relationship with traditional Chinese medicine. So I'm going to share with you, to start, an article that I wrote a few years back now on the importance of this gentle meditative movement for healing our bodies. How can we heal, or better yet, avoid stress injuries and chronic muscle fatigue? We can train our muscles to relax. Relaxed muscles allow for greater flexibility of the joints and reduced buildup of the fatigue and soreness that lead to weakness, injury, and pain. Many of us know that aerobic exercise reduces the level of our body stress hormones, such as adrenaline and cortisol. Aerobics also stimulate the production of endorphins, the body's natural painkiller and mood elevators. Most often, these are the factors that help us stick to our workout regimens and daily routines. It just feels good. Exercise can be relaxing as well as health promoting. But what happens when the remedy becomes the problem? There is nothing worse than having your best laid plans derailed because of an injury or because your muscles and ligaments have been overworked and weakened. WebMD.com recommends that one of the best ways to avoid fitness injuries is to know your body. I would expand upon this by saying the key is to pay attention to the signals and signs that your body produces. Your body can warn you of potential risks and gently steer you toward exactly what it needs and when. A good approach to sustaining your exercise program is to discover your natural rhythms, to know when to push or train hard, and to know when to rest or lighten the routine. Basic self-maintenance requires that you include a warm-up, stretch, and cool-down component with each training session. However, the most holistic and effective way to protect your body and your health is to integrate a mind-body-energy approach with your regular fitness workout and wellness program. Meditation and energy circulation exercise can ease both mental and physical stress, including the physical stress which results from heavy exercise, and the load of emotional stress that you bring from your life into the gym. Cardiologist Herbert Benson advises that any condition that is caused or worsened by stress can be alleviated through meditation. In fact, studies have shown that the relaxation response gained from meditation helps to lower blood pressure, improve heart rate and breathing, ease chronic pain, and boost immunity. Herbert Benson is the founder of the Mind-Body Institute at Harvard Medical School, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And some of the benefits of a regular practice of moving meditation are improved strength and better balance, reduced pain and stiffness, enhanced sleep, increased immunity, stamina, and vitality, improved cardiovascular, respiratory, circulatory, lymphatic, and digestive functions, decreased risk of falling, and reduced symptoms and improved function in people with fibromyalgia. There are specific Qigong routines for dealing with cancer, hypertension, chronic disease, and to relax the mind, muscles, tendons, joints, and inner organs. When we engage in a moving meditation, the positive effects of both exercise and meditation are further enhanced. Practices such as Tai Chi and Qigong integrate the desire to move with the need to meditate. While the practice appears to be very slow-moving, those movements work to build stamina and strength into the muscle fibers. And when integrated with a breath practice, it will relax the muscles, increase circulation of lymph for detoxification, and regulate the circulation of blood for increased oxygenation. The combined effect helps to keep the body fluid in motion and free of inflammation. It is the state of our energy body that determines the strength and health of our physical body and our capacity to have a clear mental process and stable emotional response to life. When we adopt a regular energy practice, we cultivate the skills necessary to communicate with the deeper parts of ourself and resolve potential health issues before they become a crisis. This allows us to stay healthy, mitigate stress, and implement the relaxation response that reduces the incidence of injury or disease and heals more fully those problems that continue to undermine our progress. In just a few moments, I am going to share an actual meditation process with you, but I have one more bit of information I want to put up front, and this is about the therapeutic effects, and this is based on actual studies and abstracts. I'll start with a study called The Application of Qigong Therapy to Healthcare. A great number of clinical studies merging traditional Chinese medicine, TCM, and Western medicine have proved the complementary healing effects of Qigong in medical science. Traditional Chinese respiration exercises help to regulate our mind, body, and breathing and coordinate our internal organs, remove toxins, and enhance immunity. Domestic and foreign studies indicate that Qigong can relieve chronic pain, reduce tension, increase activities of phagocytes, and that means that it absorbs bacteria, in choanocytes, and that is the mass enclosed by a single cell wall, or more commonly known as a tumor. So it increases the activities of phagocytes that absorbs the bacteria that is trapped in the mass enclosed single cell wall. And this allows it to absorb and release that from your body as opposed to having it stored up in your tissues. It improves cardiopulmonary function. It improves eyesight and influences the index of blood biochemistry. And the abstract title of what I've read to you is The Application of Qigong Therapy to Healthcare. And now a few more specific abstracts. And the first was published on August 1st of 2011. It was a human study. The abstract title is Qigong Mind-Body Therapy and Diabetes Control, a Randomized Controlled Trial. The background, Previous studies have shown that Qigong, a form of mind-body movement therapy, may be beneficial for people with type 2 diabetes. However, no controlled studies have been conducted to examine the predictors and mediators of Qigong effects and indicators of diabetes control. This study examined the effects of Qigong on diabetes control and identified the predictors and mediators of these effects. The setting or participants. The study included 41 participants, 16 men, and 25 women aged 41 to 71 years with elevated blood glucose levels. The interventions. Participants were randomized to Qigong intervention or a usual medical care control group. Physical and hematologic measures were assessed at baseline and after 12 weeks. Main outcome measures. The outcomes were indicators of diabetes control, HbA1c, insulin resistance, fasting blood glucose and insulin, and 2-hour blood glucose and insulin, and potential mediators of these body weight, waist circumference, and leg strength. Data were collected in 2006 and analyzed in 2007 to 2009. The results. Linear regression analysis showed significant between-group differences in favor of the intervention group in weight and waist circumference, leg strength, insulin resistance, and fasting blood insulin at 12 weeks. Logistic regression analysis showed that the Qigong intervention was a significant predictor of reduced weight. The effect of the Qigong intervention on improved insulin resistance was mediated by reduced weight. And the conclusions, the Qigong intervention was associated with improvements in weight, waist circumference, leg strength, and insulin resistance. The mediation analysis highlight the importance of weight reduction in the control of diabetes. Again, this article was published on August 1st, 2011. It is a human study, and the title of that study was Qigong Mind-Body Therapy and Diabetes Control, a Randomized Controlled Trial. Another study I would like to highlight is this, the abstract title, A Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis of the Effects of Qigong and Tai Chi for Depression Symptoms. The background. Qigong and Tai Chi are the two most popular traditional Chinese exercises known as mind-body movement therapies. Previous studies suggested that Qigong and Tai Chi may be beneficial in reducing depression symptoms. This was the first study to systematically review and compare the effects of Qigong and Tai Chi on depressive symptoms. The methods for this study. A systematic search of 6 electronic databases was undertaken through to February 2014 for randomized controlled trials, which reported depressive symptom methods. A systematic search of 6 electronic databases was undertaken through to February 2014 for randomized controlled trials, RCTs, which reported depressive symptoms measured by a depressive symptom rating scale. The standardized mean difference in depressive symptom score between Qigong and Tai Chi and a control group at the end of the follow-up was extracted as a primary outcome. The secondary outcome was that the standardized mean gain in symptom score relative to the baseline from individual arms of the RCTs for various forms of care, including Qigong, Tai Chi, usual care, other exercises, education, and miscellaneous interventions. The results. 30 studies with a total of 2,328 participants, 823 males, and 1,505 females were included. A significant effect was found for the Qigong interventions. There was no significant effect seen for Tai Chi for the primary endpoint. No mean change in symptom scores were seen for Tai Chi, usual care, other exercises, education, and the miscellaneous group in pre-post assessment in single arms. The conclusions. Qigong appears to be beneficial for reducing depressive symptom severity. This was a study. The abstract title, A Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis of the Effects of Qigong and Tai Chi for Depressive Symptoms. This article was published on July 31st, 2015, and it was a meta-analysis review. And the third and final piece that I'd like to include is information on Walking Qigong. Walking Qigong was founded by a Chinese woman named Gao Lin. She lived from 1906 to 1984. In 1949, she was diagnosed with uterine cancer and had surgery to remove it. In 1960, she had a recurrence and found it had metastasized to her bladder. Another operation was done to remove the cancerous portion of the bladder. Again, she had relapse and was given only 6 months to live. Not willing to give up her fight, she recalled the Qigong her grandfather had taught her as a child. She researched and practiced, but did not feel much results. She did more research of the ancient writings and then developed her own practice schedule. 2 hours every day, and in 6 months, her cancer had subsided. From her experience, she believed that this Qigong could help others to have more success in their fight. She combined both movement and meditative quiet Qigong. By 1977, she had achieved tremendous results. By using this simple method of walking, moving, and breathing, her students' lives were being enhanced, and many experienced recovery from their illness, and pain-free years were added to their lives. She left a marvelous legacy of hope and encouragement for all those who suffer from life-threatening illness. And you can find more about this remarkable woman at www.qigongchinesehealth.com/walking_qigong. Qigong is spelled Qigong. The bioelectromagnetic field of cancer tissues is substantially different from the normal body tissue. The biovoltage of cancer cells is much lower than that of normal body tissues. For example, with liver cancer, the biovoltage of the cancer part of the liver is negatively charged, similar to the negative pole of a battery. As the qi energy, among other things, consists of an electromagnetic field, by practicing walking qigong, you're able to enhance your bioelectromagnetic balance. And this is Catherine Davis. I host the radio programs Heart of Mind Radio on WBAI in New York and on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. Also on WBAI, Health Action. For those of you who want to find out more about what you've just listened to, you can connect with myself at the website qigongonline.net. QIGONGONLINE.net or Catherine.1, KATHRYN.ONE. And for those of you who want to make inquiries, you can call 347-480-1694. 347-480-1694. I currently have teaching sessions as well as healing sessions at Studio Maya in Brooklyn and the Open Center in Manhattan. So please connect if you have more questions. Now we'll go on to our meditation. Thank you for your time and patience. And here is the gift returned. Sitting position. Take a few moments to bring your spine into alignment. Lift your shoulders and relax from the top of your head down through the soles of your feet. Relax your head and your neck. Relax your face. Relax your neck and your shoulders. And relax from your shoulders down through your arms, all the way to your fingertips. Relax down the back of your body, starting with the back of your neck, the back of your shoulders. Relax your upper back. Relax your mid-back. Relax your lower back. Relax your buttocks. Relax down through the back of your legs. Relax the soles of your feet. Relax your face. Relax the front of your neck. And relax the front of your shoulders. Relax down through your chest. Relax down through your abdomen. Relax your waist and your hips. Relax your pelvis. Relax down through the front of your legs. Relax the top of your feet and your toes. Relax the interior of your body, starting with your brain. Relax your brain, allowing all energy to drain downward. Relax the inside of your face and the inside of your neck and throat. Relax the inside of your shoulders. Relax down through the center of your arms, all the way to your fingertips. Relax down into your chest. Relax and expand your ribs. Relax and open your lungs. Relax and calm your heart. Relax down into your abdomen. Relax your stomach. Relax your spleen. Relax your liver. Relax your kidneys. Relax your pancreas. Relax your intestines. Relax your colon. relax your bladder. Relax your ovaries or gonads, sexual organs. Relax down through the interior, the inside of your legs. Again, allow your spine to find its balance by gently rolling upward, making sure that the vertebrae are in alignment. Lifting your head, relax your shoulders. And gently bring one shoulder back, allowing the spine to turn. Allow your head to move in the direction of your shoulder. Allow the hips to also move gently, one flowing back, the other gently forward. And then slowly reverse your position, bringing your head gently towards the other side. Turning your head back. Allow your shoulders to follow your head. Allowing the spine to turn. Gently shift the hips so that one is back, the other forward. So continue for a few more of these shifting movements so that when your left shoulder goes back, your left hip goes back, your head turns to the left, and just allow the spine to shift gently. And as you gently move to the other side, as your head turns to the right and goes back, allow your shoulder, right hip to follow the movement of your head. And gently shift your whole body, gently rotating the spine so that one side of your body moves together and the opposite side of your body moves together in opposing directions back and forth. And gently do one or two more.
And you are listening
to back to the center.
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
And with your exhaled breath, just send a wave of relaxation through the whole body from the top of your head to the soles of your feet. Inhale deeply. Exhale slowly. Again, inhale deeply. Exhale slowly. One more. Inhale deeply. Exhale slowly.
And now we're going to have a very abrupt change in mood. You're listening to WBAI New York, and coming up now is Hour of the Wolf. I'm Ken Gale, substituting for Jim Freund.
I wanna be
And those were the Tearjerkers, a band out of Belfast. I don't know if they're performing anymore, but I was using that song as the theme to Enough Said for all. I was doing that show from 93 until 2007, and then occasionally since then. Today, I am presenting an interview with Mark Hamill. Yes, that Mark Hamill. Of course, he's best known as being Luke Skywalker in the Star Wars movies, but that's not the Mark Hamill that I interviewed. Because besides being an actor in Star Wars, he's also a voice actor, and he is very well known as a voice actor for probably being the best actor to perform the Joker, which he did on a Batman animated show. But he's also a major comic book fan, and I ran into him at a comic book store back in, I would have to say it was probably late 80s. And Mark and I, and I'm Ken Gale, by the way, Mark and I shopped at the same comic book store on the west side of Manhattan back when he was living in that area. And one day he comes in, and I knew that we had very similar tastes in comics. And when he came in, I recognized him and started talking to him about Silver Age DC comics, because he's very much into those. He started reading comics before Marvel Comics even existed. That didn't happen until 62. And though he read them when they came out, he continued to be a bigger fan of what he started with, which were the DC comics of the late 50s. At any rate, my wife was with me. Now, we had gone into the store, my wife and I, with her little sister, who did not want to go into the store, but, you know, we wanted to pick up our week's comics. And my wife was also buying some classic underground comics. And it turned out that Mark Hamill's into classic undergrounds as well. So the two of them are chatting about classic undergrounds. However, my wife did not recognize Mark Hamill. He looked familiar to her, and she couldn't figure out where he knew her. And he could tell that she was trying to figure out who he was and didn't recognize him. And he also realized that I did recognize him but was being discreet. Meanwhile, her little sister had her back to us the whole time. She wanted to go in there and get out as soon as she can. And here we were talking to some guy about comic books. Are we ever going to get out of there? But my wife had to take her little sister to a lot of bad movies. She was 10 years younger, and she was just at the right age to have her little teeny bopper crush on Mark Hamill. And I made her big sister take her to a lot of bad movies because Mark Hamill was in them. But she didn't realize that she was in his presence at that very moment. And so we have this great conversation. Went on for a good amount of time. And he's talking about some of his memories of the classic undergrounds, his memories of Silver Age DC comics. Silver Age DCs started in the 56. When the Silver Age ended is up for dispute. And I don't want to go into that right now. And so we get home, and I said, that's a really nice conversation we had with Mark Hamill. And she's like, that's who that was. And her little sister's like, oh, no. Well, you should have told me. I said, how am I supposed to tell you? In the middle of a crowded comic book store on a Saturday, I'm supposed to yell out, hey, you know you're talking to Mark Hamill, right? Oh, no. Well, you should have been able to figure out something. I'm like, what? And to this day, we haven't figured out how I could have let her know in a discreet way that she was talking to Mark Hamill. Meanwhile, her little sister's, oh, no. So years go by, and now my wife and I are publishing Evolution Comics. We're guests at a lot of conventions. And there's Mark Hamill was a guest at one of the same conventions we had. He was plugging a video game that he was doing the voices for. And he was doing a signing at 10 o'clock when the convention opened. I'm like, hey, we get to go in early, so I'll talk to him before the crowd gets here. So I go over to the booth of that gaming company, and
say, you know, I went to the same comic shop. I do a radio show. I wanted to talk to him about coming onto the radio. And the guy goes, oh, he's busy. I said, no, he's not. He's right over there. And I pointed. He's like, he goes over there, and I hear Mark go, where is he? And he comes over, and I'm like, I don't know if you remember me from West Side Comics. And he goes, you're with a woman, right? And he remembered my wife a whole lot better than he remembered me. And then he agreed to come on to Enough Said. The show was on at 4 in the morning on November 8th, 1995. So what you're about to hear is over 22 years old. And it took place at 4 in the morning. And back then, WBAI had a monthly magazine that we gave to our listener supporters called The Folio. And they asked all the producers to give a write-up of you know, who their guests were for, the following month. So I gave the editor, Dave Burstein, here, this is who's coming on November 8th. And he looks at it, and Mark Hamill goes, I should know this name, right? I went, yeah. He goes, he's an actor, right? I went, yeah. What's he doing on at 4 in the morning? And I said, because that's when my show is on. And he goes, well, that's wrong. But at any rate, this is... what you're going to hear is that interview. We talked a lot about comics. So I kind of wanted to recreate as much as I could of that conversation at West Side Comics. But also, Mark Hamill has, he was the voice of the Joker, and he has been reading some of the president's tweets using that voice. And it's absolutely wonderful. You have to, I brought four of them. He's done like six. I brought four of them, and I'll let you hear two now, and then I'll let you hear two more at the end of the show. And I will follow the two tweets with, I broke up the interview, which is well over an hour long, into three parts. So here is Mark Hamill as the Joker, reading tweets from the president.
Happy New Year to all, including to my many enemies and those who have fought me and lost so badly. They just don't know what to do. Love. I heard poorly rated morning show speaks badly of me. Don't watch anymore. Then how come low IQ crazy Mika along with Psycho Joe came to Mar-a-Lago three nights in a row around New Year's Eve and insisted on joining me? She was bleeding badly from the facelift. I said no!
Isn't that amazing?